Okay. Perfect.
Okay.
Oh, you're using your
phone.
Okay.
The quality of the microphone has gotten really wonderful. So
I know somebody just gave me a Sony that's really remarkably better than mine.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Great. Okay. So
you must be ready, so I guess I'm gonna fill that out later.
Oh no, I need to check the sound just to make sure it's working and everything. So we can talk for just a second, just to see if the sound is working. But has it been a good day for you?
It's hard to remember. Yes, I'm cleaning house around my paperwork and so forth on the desk to get ready for a new project. So,
oh, good.
So that's good. I realized you have to do that every once in a while. You have to do maintenance. So I gave myself permission to do that. I keep thinking, do the most important thing today, and then other things don't happen. So.
Yeah, it was kind of funny because my boyfriend who drove me over here, I gave him the address and gave him the directions and stuff, and he looked it up on his phone, and he's like, who are you interviewing? His house is a landmark! And I was like, no, he works from home. So that was pretty pretty funny for him.
So are you undergraduate?
I am, yes.
Senior?
I'm a senior.
Yeah, okay, good. So what's your degree?
I'm English and creative writing, but always loved oral history. I took a class on the Southern Historical Collection, which your interview will be housed in. In freshman year, I took a class and kind of learned about that through there. And then I've always been interested in oral history and storytelling. So I finally got the internship this year. So
great. It's
been really great.
Well, the article you sent me, I read today. That was a pretty remarkable little article. I had not.
Yeah.
I mean, I learned some things. I had not realized that it started in 69 and ended in 73, basically, the 4 years I was there.
Yeah.
So, and you know, because Chris left and we graduated, and and then that was
a very short time period.
Very interesting.
And it's great because you were pretty much at the nucleus of everything that was happening and the stuff that I'm interested in researching.
And that whole research that we did, I may have mentioned it to you. Well, we'll talk about it later. I'm not going to start telling all the stories now.
Okay.
Not that there are any. I don't remember that much.
Okay, and I'm just gonna set my recorder
right
here.
The sound quality sounds good?
Yeah, that's just a view, though.
Okay. Okay.
Okay, my name is Ashley Templeton. Oh, it's going. That's good. My name is Ashley Templeton. I am at Dr. Reed Wilson's house and in his at-home office, and we are conducting an oral history on the sexual revolution of the 1970s. So we can start off just talking a little bit about you and your childhood, if that's an okay place to start.
Okay.
Is that okay with you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where did you grow up?
I was born in Raleigh,
mm-hmm.
raised in Charlotte.
Okay, great. So can you tell me a little bit about your childhood? About did you grow up with siblings?
I had two siblings, an older brother, a year and a half older than me, and then a surprise younger sister, 7 years younger. So.
Awesome. So what was there anything during your childhood that influenced you wanting to either go to UNC or influenced your interest in sexuality and sexual education or anything like that? Or do you just want to talk a little bit about maybe your school years and how your interests developed there?
Well, sure. I guess it's in some way a public record that I did have a problem pregnancy when I was 16.
Mm-hmm.
And that influenced me significantly and really in many ways being a psychologist today.
Mm-hmm.
And back in those days, there were not abortion clinics around anywhere in the United States. I was totally freaked out as a 16-year-old and was very involved in the Catholic Church. And so I finally talked to my priest, and I was so frightened. He and I were close. I'd been doing projects with him. And so forth, and I can still remember walking across that parking lot of the church and trying to say it to him, and just seeing his what we would call flat affect. He had no reaction in terms of I was ready to be shamed,
mm-hmm.
And he didn't do that. actually, he could not help me himself because it was against the church doctrine, but he did get me in with a pastor of another Protestant church, and they helped us. I talked to my girlfriend's father. We worked all that out. They flew to England for an abortion. And that was really the turning point for me in terms of, if it weren't for my tenacity, in terms of trying to figure out what was going on, things would have gone much differently for me. And I felt like I never wanted anybody else to be in that position again. I think lots of people in the world have that experience in one domain or another. But that was where it started for me, which is people do not have the information. They don't have the choice. And so I'm 62 and I've spent my entire career working on self-help. It's all I do. It's all I think about. And so that, it's a big thing. Of course, even saying this, it's kind of a breach of family protocol or a kind of a taboo around the family to even be sharing that. So, but what the heck?
How do you think that event, you said it influenced you as a professional in your interests and what you wanted to do. How do you think it influenced you as a person, I guess, personally? Being 16, did you grow up quickly because of that event, or?
Well, there was the typical, sense of shame at some level. My father was very clear that my mother couldn't handle the information as a Catholic, and that she was, fragile, and so. But again, the adults around me stepped up, and I didn't have to take on too many adult responsibilities as a 16-year-old. There's other information in my childhood that I'm not going to share with you,
right,
which I have not shared with you, and so there was all of that building up to this, so you're missing that other piece, which again is a kind of taboo conversation that isn't open,
right, that's
information. So, but I don't know that I grew up dramatically then. I was already pretty grown up in terms of what my responsibilities were in the world and in my family. So I had parental responsibilities as a 6-year-old on forward. So if you can read between the lines about that.
Okay, cool. So how did you get to UNC? Kind of describe your journey there after.
Sure. Well, in high school, I was big into drama, theater, speaking, National Forensic League debates, all of that work. And I loved that. That was really my life. My grades were okay. My college advisor said, don't bother applying to UNC. You'll never get in. I applied early admission and got in. So that was great. UNC was the only place I applied to. And I always had wanted to go there. And I went to, ended up in Morrison Dorm on South Campus, which is a 10-story, 1,000 students or so.
Yeah.
And so that was exciting for me as well. So that's how it unfolded nicely for me. And of course, when you're in Charlotte and you get to go to UNC, it's a wonderful thing.
Yeah. Can you describe just your first impression of UNC freshman year? What year did you start the Human Information and Sexuality Counseling Services? What year was that?
Well, it was 1970, I believe. I actually ran and was elected governor of Morrison Dorm, so I did. That was my first foray into activism on campus, and that next year was, so my sophomore year I was governor.
Okay.
And in my sophomore year, October or so, I decided to create a Sexual Revolution Month or something like that, but basically it was to start educating students really across campus, but we brought it at Marston Dorm. So that was my first action in the field of sexuality, and that was very successful in terms of people coming in and wanting to get information and so forth. I had met Dr. Tyke Crist, mm-hmm. who was an OBGYN at the School of Medicine. He was a activist. When he found out what I was doing, he started talking more to me and figuring out what we could do next. He was beginning to do the presentations across campus and so forth, and began to talk about creating a course which was Topics in Human Sexuality. Very politically loaded action. This was, in those years, the Student Health Service was very anti-contraception. Boys were supposed to keep it in their pants, and they were not prescribing for the co-eds. So it was a pretty bad scene. If a co-ed went for contraception, she more likely than not got shamed. Mm-hmm. There, it was awful. So I was certainly feeling pretty aggressive about all of that. I was excited that the course was going to begin, and so I coordinated with him that spring, the graduate students. So we would have 250 undergraduates. Mm-hmm. The College of Arts and Sciences wouldn't take the class, so we were able to get it in with the School of Public Health. So it was actually a graduate class, Health mm-hmm. Education 33, mm-hmm. that allowed undergraduates to get credit. Mm-hmm. And it was really the first credited college campus in the country that taught sexuality. Other campuses were doing some things, but it was all on the side. So again, that was very exciting, recruiting graduate students, and here I am, a little 18-year-old, getting. So we would, have the presentation on a Monday night, and then the groups would meet some other time during the week, like 7 or 12 students and the graduate student facilitating a mm-hmm. conversation. So that's really where it began.
Right.
And then out of that, I felt like we needed to go further, and that's when I started talking about the Human Sexuality Information and Counseling Service.
Great. Just backing up a little bit, when you first got to UNC, what was your perception of the undergraduates' knowledge of their own sexuality and sexual education? Could you tell that there was a void that needed to be filled in terms of sexual education? Could you tell that people were uninformed?
Well, I don't know that I could tell. I wasn't surveying. I wasn't asking all my friends what they knew and so forth. I just already knew, in essence, that we were missing the information. Right. Where do you go? Well, there was nothing. You couldn't read anything. There were no books you could get. So it was, I knew coming in, but, mm-hmm. Not until we started the counseling service, or really until the course, when you started listening to students, you reading their evaluations at the end of the semester and so forth, where their, eyes kind of open, where a guy decides as his project in the semester to go to a gay bar and for the first time see what that's like. And mm-hmm. so that was made it very clear to me once we started doing the course in terms of what was missing and what needed. Now, of course, some kids were like sexuality class, but for the most part, they had to work and it was being watched. And so it was we really felt like we were doing something to help them be more responsible as opposed to more sexually active,
right,
as it were.
Can you describe a little bit more the difficulties of getting Help 33 started? Was the university particularly opposed, or was it just hard to get it into anything other than the School of Public Health? And I read a letter that y'all had trouble getting funding, a letter that you wrote mm-hmm. Requesting funding and being denied. So was that a major component of the course?
Sure. The undergraduate school wanted, Arts and Science wanted to have nothing to do with it. The dean of Arts and Sciences felt like, I've heard this language before, but I've never seen it written, and I would never, this is when Elephants and Butterflies came out, mm-hmm. Dr. Chris' first book that really helped educate students around contraception and such. So he was opposed to any of this movement in this direction. We also had Jesse Helms, who had been a TV commentator on WRAL and really was anti-UNC, saw us this liberal campus that mm-hmm. they should put a fence around us to protect us. So there was some guarding against the conservatives coming in. The legislature funds the University of North Carolina, so when we have conservative legislatures hearing that we're doing this liberal stuff, this was the late 60s, this was Vietnam, this was, you know, the beginning of the drug culture, so lots was going on, and then we're trying to bring this stuff in at the same time. We got very little money. I think we had like $200 the first year. Dr. Chris didn't take any money at all for it. Then the second year, you know, he basically said we can't bring any speakers in if we don't have any funds. And although when they approved the course in the School of Public Health, even that was a tricky thing. And his agreement that he made was that he was to do no marketing. It could only be filled word of mouth. He was not allowed to do any public relations stuff, anything in the news and so forth, which he respected all of one semester, I think. And then he said, you know, we have to have funds. And he raised holy hell, and it really took about 8 days before they decided to scrape together enough money to continue it, because the fallout was going to be not worth it. It was clear that the students were behind us, and they would love to get up in arms around all this being withheld, plus a way to express their frustration around student health service as well.
Right. So the opposition is coming from the parents, not the students, correct?
Not the parents.
Or the
administration.
Administration.
Yeah.
Okay.
And to some degree, some faculty, mm-hmm. but the faculty are more careful.
Right.
Cautious. I don't need trouble.
Right. So. Can you describe the student reception? I talked to Dr. Schoenbach a couple weeks ago, and he mentioned that people would camp overnight to sign up for this course. Do you remember anecdotes like that?
Well, I don't. I know that we had 400 students on the waiting list. The first semester, I think we did 200 students, and then after that we did 250 every semester, and you know, it's just a terribly popular course after the first semester, but I don't remember those details.
Okay. So what were your duties as a discussion leader organizer? Were you in charge of the grad students and helped instruct them on how to lead their discussion groups?
Yes, but I was 18, so I mainly did administration, and I coordinated it, and you know, I did whatever Dr. Chris wanted me to do, and so, but helping recruit them, I didn't train them per se, because I had no business doing that, but it was mainly administrative, and it's always been the way I learn as I start off doing responsibilities that are within my purview and my capabilities, and just start absorbing information, so that's how it began for me.
Yeah, so how did it feel being 18 in that kind of setting? With the graduate students, you said you kind of gradually learned, and that's how you learn. Did you feel that that helped you gain confidence enough to take your own leadership roles on campus, or were you already in that position of confidence?
Well, I was aggressive. People were so naive about sexuality, and so even I didn't feel intimidated by the graduate students because they didn't know that much either.
Right.
A lot of them came out of the School of Public Health. They'd had some group facilitation work. But again, we're talking about stuff that nobody had ever talked about before. So I felt like I had some, you know, leadership capabilities. And But obviously, the more things you do, the more you learn, the more talks you sit in on, the more information you absorb, and then you can move on to the next step.
Right.
But I was aggressive. I wanted to keep moving.
Right. So I know most of the content of Health 33, about contraception, about just the human body, abortion, how to deal with relationships. What do you think was the most important thing for students at that time out of the content?
Well, you know, I did my honors thesis on the course. And so what it seemed, you know, what I looked at was sex, attitude, knowledge, and behavior. Mm-hmm. And so clearly their attitudes shifted to be more accepting of lifestyles. They clearly learned the information that they needed to. In my thesis, a random sample of the campus was my control group. And what even in the sample or the campus as a whole, sexual activity dramatically changed in the 4 years that we were there. I mean, dramatically. Mm-hmm. Women and men averaged 73% had sexual intercourse and were much more likely to use contraception except for the first event. Mm-hmm. The first time they had sex, you know, you get swept up by the moment. You don't want to mention these things. So that piece may have gotten in place around a course, but that piece wasn't in place overall. Mm-hmm. To me, I don't know what they got that was most important to them. To me, it was that you could talk about it. That was the most important piece to me. And you may know that we actually didn't do any. At least in the beginning, anything on homosexuality.
Right.
So when I did started the counseling service, we were moving to that territory for the first time, which was semi-alarming to me.
Right.
But so, you know, and I don't know what Dr. Chris's point of view was about that. He and I never talked about it. I didn't, probably wasn't even on my radar about that. So.
Yeah, and I want to get back to that, but on Dr. Chris, I'd love to talk to him about him a little bit. What kind of person was he, and how did he deal with the controversial nature of the work that you did together? And just what was it like to work with him? I guess mostly.
Well, it was thrilling to work with him because he was very dynamic. He was a physician who took me under his wing. It was a remarkable thing. I felt so fortunate. We're talking about just, you know, two or three people that were doing that with him. And he was very dynamic, very outspoken. Mm-hmm. He loved his role, I'm sure. I mean, I know this role, so because I've been in this role now, you know, through my career, but he loved what he did. Mm-hmm. He clearly was an advocate for the women on campus. I mean, more than anything, he wanted to look out for the women and was, I can get sad or emotional just thinking about his passion around that. And it's like, I mean, the limitations around abortion, around contraception, but more than anything, the contraception that you would allow, you know, 12% of the women on campus were getting pregnant. That's a large number.
Right.
And that needed to change. And you can't have these kinds of sexual attitudes that are preventing them from getting the information that they needed and the contraception that they needed. So he was a pretty passionate guy.
Right.
So when he goes up against, you know, later in my senior year, I did a what's called the North Carolina workshop on problem pregnancy counseling. And so when he gave, you know, so we had a debate between him and a anti-abortion advocate, and he was slaughtered. Chris couldn't hold up to the other guy. Wilkie was his name, and Wilkie was so smooth, so skilled as a speaker, so good at a debater, had sly, I mean, everything that they do in pro-life, you know, was there. So that was the one time I ever saw him just get clobbered in an experience. So, but, you know, the your to answered it in terms of my feelings about being around him and the excitement.
Right, yeah. And it's great to hear about what kind of a person he was, because his name has come up a lot, too. And I'd love to be able to talk to him at some point. But what was the dynamic of the small group discussions? Were you actually a leader for one of the small group discussions, or just mainly administrative?
Yeah, I was all administrative.
Okay.
And so, you know, they had assignments that we worked out ahead of time. I would work out with Dr. Christ around what kind of questions that they would have them open up in group discussion. Some of them were not trained in group dynamics, and so we did some training of them early on. Again, I just coordinated. I didn't run it.
Right.
And then, so they had tasks to be doing. They had the students had assignments that they had to do, and those got filtered through the leaders as well. So
right. When I talked to Dr. Schoenbach, he kind of described the 70s as the era of the small group discussion, which was kind of a foreign term to me because I thought group discussions just happened all of the time. But do you feel...
Well, it was... small group dynamics were big. I think you're right. Small group discussions go on all the time and seminars and so forth. But group dynamics in psychotherapy and elsewhere were very big at that point. Tavistock groups, which are leaderless groups and so forth, were on the rise. And so, you know, that was,
right.
I think that was more what was happening. So there was a counseling, something called co-counseling, where so peer counseling was coming into the forefront as well, and peer counseling would be, you know, as it sounds like, two people are just trained in a process of listening and giving feedback without giving advice, and they met, you know, once a week or twice a week, and each had time and so forth. So that whole helping each other kind of process was growing at that point.
Mm-hmm. Can you speak to the kind of things that were talked about during the discussions, or if you can't because you're more administrative? Okay, that's totally fine.
Well, that many years ago.
Yeah, that's totally fine. Do you think the peer counseling that was popular during the time and happening during this course, do you think that influenced your decision to start the human counseling services?
Yeah, well, there's no counseling associated with the course itself, so
right.
There was that group dynamics, and I don't really know what triggered all my decision about going forward. Part of what my concern was is that not enough information was getting to enough people,
right.
And that people were moving into crisis, and you know, from my experience having the problem pregnancy, that was
right.
A big thing for me, and so. It just seemed like a natural process to me, and I think maybe it was the beginning of this whole side of me thinking about counseling. And, you know, the coursework is the coursework, but when you're in trouble,
right.
You know, or your boyfriend's physically abused, I mean, we got everything from mm-hmm. physical abuse to, you know, the works in that process. So I think more the one-on-one issues were around emergencies, crises,
mm-hmm.
lack of information. I'm making a decision and I feel blind about what to do. We're lost. Those kind of things were moving me at that point.
Did you face the same kind of problems against the administration in starting your counseling service as there was with the Help 33 class?
We didn't have much trouble starting it
mm-hmm.
because we don't ask anybody. We just
right,
did it.
Just,
and we went
yeah.
through student government and set it up. And I just stuck an ad in the paper. We actually had students plus community people
mm-hmm.
In the training. And we answered calls from students plus community people. So it wasn't totally the student body that we worked with. And we, you know, were set up in a little room in the student union. And at one point, I had one of my sheets or something from my own dorm room that I put up to have a partition there. And so we had hours that we'd work manning the phones, personing the phones. And then we had walk-in as well. Most of it was telephone, but a lot of it was, I mean, some of it was walk-in as well. And I think we were averaging about 800 to 900 cases per semester, okay. About 1,600 per
That's
year. The only peer counseling service in the country was at Boulder, and mm-hmm. Boulder was limited to just contraception. And we were doing everything at
right.
that point, and that we were also allowing community people to talk to us and get help as well. And
mm-hmm.
that was really exciting time.
Right.
And of course we had great parties as, you know, I felt like it was like the band or something.
Yeah.
We just, you know, there was there was like 21 of us or so that were part of it all, roughly that. And we just were very close knit
mm-hmm.
folks. And again, to get to know older people out in the community, and it was a wonderful and exciting time.
Right. What kinds of people from the community were becoming involved?
They just housewives, younger,
mm-hmm.
young professionals. I don't know enough about, remember much about what they were doing, what their professions were.
Right.
But they were just, I don't remember having any trouble with anyone,
mm-hmm.
which seems surprising.
Right,
now,
exactly.
I may just have amnesia for the trouble.
Mm-hmm.
But they just were, everybody cooperated, everybody served their time on doing the phones, nobody was competing for whatever, and people were dedicated to, you know, making a contribution. And at that point, I was doing training with them, and,
mm-hmm.
and we had a physician who eventually came from the Student Health Service
mm-hmm.
To help and to educate them, do some trainings with me. And then it started to get a little tight. The Student Health Service wanted to clamp down. They wanted to know what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted a faculty person kept in the loop continually.
Mm-hmm.
I think Dr. Chris got worried at some point because
right.
he wasn't part of it. Anyway, this is totally my thing now.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could imagine him having some control issues. And you're talking about a 19-year-old.
Right.
You know, what's going to happen? And so... So they got a little tight for a while. Nobody tried to shut us down or close us out. Eventually, Bruce Baldwin came on board. He was a psychologist who worked with Student Health Service and was pretty much on our side.
Mm-hmm.
And so he served, I think, for a couple of years as the liaison from
mm-hmm.
Student Health Service. And he and I worked together well. We wrote, I think, published three articles together.
Mm-hmm.
So that settled down.
Right.
You know, after there was this little eruption, more or less. So.
Right. Do you have any stories by chance that kind of stick out in your memory about the kind of camaraderie of the fellow counselors or anything? Any good?
Well, I mean, I don't know about the camaraderie part. What I think of was when we decided to bring on gay members
right.
in order to have them trained to respond. And I absolutely remember Bill Griffin and I were going into this meeting with these maybe about seven guys in the student union, and I was so scared because in my mind I said, I'm liberal. I don't know anything about this. I literally can still remember saying, what if I kind of get tapped like a magic wand or something and find out that I'm attracted to men? And I is like, and it was really walking in that room was like 6 seconds. It was like, oh, well, that's over. I mean, that was so useful to me.
Right.
To have that anticipatory dread. I mean, I work with anxiety disorders.
Right.
And all all we talk about is anticipatory dread and anxiety of an event, and so to have it just change in a flash was really enlightening to me and useful
mm-hmm.
to me for a very long time. So that stands out for me a lot. And I you know, as we continued in year three was when I decided, you know, I went again out further. Well, one, I my honors thesis and the random sample, what I didn't know was that my random sample, the instruments I used were used in a random sample 4 years prior by Carl Bauman at the School of Public Health. And he discovers that I have done this, and they were going to repeat their study in 10 years to see what changes took place.
Right.
And when we analyzed the data, what he was, we were able to find out was that what they predicted was going to happen in 10 years in terms of sexual behavior happened in 4 years. So, you know, going from like 37% of the population of,
right.
of the undergraduates being sexually active to 73% is just unheard of.
Right.
You know, we were talking about those 4 years, it's just unheard of. So, what happened at that point was I was taking that data to go to the administration and saying, we need to be serving these students. We need to be prescribing contraception. And they wouldn't even talk to me. And, you know, I told the dean of students that if he doesn't talk to me about this, let's address it, I'm just going to go to the media. And so they never talked to me, and then I went to the media. And that was intense in terms of the heat that came down at UNC because I released that information. And then, you know, there's a lot of negative publicity
right.
for the university, the exact thing that Jesse Helms wanted to
right.
take advantage of. You know, to some degree, that was my naivete as a
right.
undergraduate, that I was, again, mad and digressing. And if you're not going to, you know,
something's
got to happen.
Once you release something to the media, you
right.
can't control it anymore.
Right. But there's obviously, if I was more diplomatic and more mature, I would have found some other ways. I could have threatened them a little longer or something. I think I wanted the attention to some degree of that data, so I got that. The last thing I was saying, you didn't even ask me about this, but then where I went to next was to try to get more information in the state itself. And so I put together a group of seven organizations, the School of Public Health, the Department of Health, North Carolina Department of Health, North Carolina Department of Social Services, and large statewide organizations, and we organized this workshop on problem pregnancy counseling. And I think it was 97 or all 100 counties in the state were represented at that conference, and that was a tremendous. I was so happy with how all that went, that we could do what we've been doing at UNC, but out to the state as a whole, we. Actually wrote a book, counselors wrote chapters, and we got physicians to write chapters and so forth, and actually published a book that we gave to everybody who attended, and then a separate supplement with all the resources of all the abortion clinics, which were legal in Washington, D.C. and New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And all of those clinics came to the conference with exhibits, and then Wilkie came with his very large
yeah.
exhibit, which you get like three spaces to kind of balance everything out and get
yeah.
really well done and very beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And he needed to be there. I mean, he
right.
needed to be there. It was totally appropriate. So that I was really happy about doing that work. And then I'm, you know, at that point, I'm ready to move on to my next work after graduation.
Right. Going back to the counseling services, in my research, I looked at your first annual report.
Oh, you found it.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, it was in Dr. Christ's materials or somewhere else?
It was in the, just the student government files.
Oh.
So,
my goodness.
So I have for the fall of 1971 to the spring of 1972, and it was great kind of getting to see what kind of questions students were asking. I have down that a lot of the questions dealt with female guilt, which you've talked about a little bit. Do you think that having the counseling service, or what kind of impact do you think the counseling service was able to have on women like this?
Well, I think there was, everything was so shrouded. You really, I mean, not that I knew exactly what went on in conversation with co-eds, but it was difficult to talk to your friends about your concerns. And when you're with your boyfriend, it's just you and your boyfriend trying to figure these things out. When you get confused or in a dilemma, or he's, you know, putting pressure on you, it gets really confusing to you. So I think what we allowed is for the, you know, this anonymous telephone call. That mm-hmm. the phones, that's why the phones were so much more active than people coming in person.
Right.
You have a chance, and we advertised everywhere. And I don't know if you saw any of the posters.
I saw a flyer.
But, you know, we did all kinds of clever posters to get their attention. So people knew we were there. And that was, I think, important to do. And I think that just that bridging the gap where you can talk anonymously to somebody and say, I'm feeling confused, or I did something last night and I don't know what to do now. Those kinds of things. And that's what we did, is
right.
responding to them. And if it's education, then education. A lot of it was education, but also some kind of permission to be yourself and stand up for yourself and figure out what the guilt is about. And so I think those were important tasks that we had.
Right. Do you remember?
There was a learning curve around that, trying to figure all those things out. Those were what our meetings were for, trying to process, you know, what we're
right.
hearing and how do we talk about it, and that, you know, some of our trainings would be about that. Where do we go next? Because we had nothing to study.
Right. You know? The learning curve was actually one of my questions. I wanted to ask you, what kind of obstacles internally did you come up against, or maybe what was one of the big ones? Like the learning, did you find after doing some of the counseling that any of your teachings had been misled, or that people that were counselors weren't qualified, or were there any things that you needed to update, or what kind of?
I don't have a memory of that.
Okay, cool. Do you remember any of the things that you had on your posters? It sounded like you had some clever things in your mind.
I think, unfortunately, we're doing this recording now. I can, you know, I think I could go in my attic and find one. I was reading one today. If you read that, it was, hey, Charlie, did you score last night?
Oh.
Did you remember that one? Did you see that one?
I think I did.
So, you know, it's a guy kind of winking, oh, we're doing an okay sign. Did you score last night? Which in a drawing, my roommate and good friend, Robert Donnelly was doing the drawings for us, a great artist.
Mm-hmm.
And so that caught their attention. But the punchline was, did you bring contraception? Did you have a condom? Was she using an IUD? You know, sex is your responsibility too.
Mm-hmm.
So some of them were educational kind of implying responsibility or guilt provoking. Some of the others were more like, call us if you need it. So that was the direction that we'd take. And, you know, women needed help.
Right.
Nobody was on their side about this kind of stuff. So I think they were the weaker gender in those times because of the pressure that was felt. So, I mean, the activity, when you get up to 73% of all 4 years having at least one sexual encounter, it's very difficult to be a virgin and let anybody know about that. And some of the conversations, as you know, were about that.
Right.
I'm trying to hold off. And so,
one question I wanted to ask you about the counselor training. You mentioned in the annual report, I'm just going to read from here, said about the problem pregnancy counselors in specific, and it says they were prepared to discuss the 5 alternatives open to a pregnant woman: to be married and keep the child, to be single and keep the child, to place the child up for adoption, to have an abortion, or to commit suicide. And I was wondering if that was more the addition of the or commit suicide, was that something that was actually happening, or was it just more of a to show how severe the problem was? Or,
well, I mean, I feel it when you read it. Committing suicide is a viable option. And when you're talking to somebody, you might, you know, for you to respond by not talking about that, you know, it was not helpful. Let's put it all on the table. You have a choice of committing suicide, and let's talk about what, you know, how we're going to respond to that particular piece. But I think it was more of an acknowledgement of how desperate they right. can become. Most of these women, you know, the vast majority of them, did not want to have the child.
Right.
They didn't want to die either. But again, I can relate to being, you know, feeling like my life is ruined until you figure out what to do next. So,
right. It was interesting that you brought up the homosexual counselors. Because the article that actually got me interested in the Human Sexuality Information and Counseling Services was an article I found about the DTH talking about how you just hired two new gay resource counselors and how interesting that was and wondering about how that was going to go. And I have here a quote that summarizes what you kind of mentioned as anxiety towards, like, what's going to happen, or I don't know very much about the homosexual presence on campus. It says, no one was quite sure what to do. We concluded that we should handle it with the same sensitivity as we do other cases. The difficult questions we would refer to professionals, but the answer didn't quite satisfy us, but we knew no other solution. And then it goes on to say that you were fortunate enough to have the two homosexual counselors join your team. Can you describe a little bit, and you said it didn't really change the or did it change the dynamic having those homosexual counselors in there? Were they kind of welcomed?
I only remember one of the two. I know him now because he still lives nearby here, and every once in a while he comes up and talks to me. And so, you know, they were well integrated. There was no, you know, they're just nice human beings. And you need to talk to someone else who's gay if you're gay.
Right.
You know, and again, what's alluded there is like we were law. We were inventing what to do. We had to just plug it into whatever else we were doing because it just made the most sense to us to do it that way. But, you know, the part of what was going on was men who were coming out or possibly, you know, coming out to themselves, they were becoming alcoholics because they couldn't cope with the dynamic of this discovery. And so again, you're like, it's the same thing around contraception. The first night or first time when you have sex, it's like, I can't accept this. And so just like everything else, they needed somebody to bridge this to help pull them up. And they weren't going to student health service. Of course, they could barely go talking about contraception. You're not going to go talking about being gay because nobody trusted student health service.
Right.
Things were starting to change by 72, 73 in terms of Dr. Baldwin was helping us. We were starting to identify who we could send them to or who could come in and talk with us about it. But, well, again, you know, those 4 years are changing rapidly. So a lot changed in year four.
What was the reception on campus, do you think, to, was the gay community very present? I know the Carolina Gay Association started in 74. On campus, was homosexuality a big problem, or was it one of the lesser discussed issues?
Never spoken about.
Okay.
Nobody was pulling together. It was no activity, no groups, no nothing.
Okay.
So it was all one-on-one or individuals.
Yeah.
Which is a problem,
right,
of course.
Right.
Right. I'm the only one. I mean, again, you have to understand that back then, when you started to have feelings for somebody of your own gender, you don't know other people have those feelings too. Back this 1970, really, it was, and so you could imagine. Suicide is a possibility. I mean, today I work with obsessive compulsive disorder, and it's still the same way with obsessive compulsive disorder. You start having thoughts of harming your child, and you would rather commit suicide than harm your child. You don't realize you have a mental health disorder over here. And the same with the gay issues. It's like, it is not acceptable for me to have these feelings. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. I have written here that based on the questions that students asked about homosexuality, that they only saw two extremes. Either they were gay or they weren't gay. And you mentioned here that they could not envision one sexuality being in place along a continuum, and they would come in and ask, am I gay? Can you tell me? And like the counselors weren't able to answer that exactly, because it's kind of not a question. You have to answer it for yourself, I guess. But
yes, but now, of course, since I'm in the field of anxiety disorders, some of those students had obsessive compulsive disorder and were not gay. They just thought they might be, and that would be awful. So that was a piece we would have no idea about, because we were clueless about that particular disorder. But part of, in terms of that continuum piece, what we were trying to convey is one homosexual act does not make a homosexual. That was something that we had to continue to present to people, because they would get drunk, have this activity, and then feel this sense of shame and remorse and suicidal ideation. And, you know, some of them were reaching out to us, and then we were trying to literally talk them down or back from that, which is conveying, you know, this is a behavior, you're not ready to decide what your lifestyle is yet. And actually a lot of that, you don't, even if you find out that you're gay, you don't have to act on it. I mean, that's part of the thing that we had to convey to them, because of the shame piece, that they could know who they were inside and choose not to take any action at this point, not because we were feeling conservative, but just slow down, son.
Yeah.
So,
and this question, I'm not asking you to like say for sure, but what did you feel was the biggest problem that students came to the counseling service with? What do you think was
contraception?
Contraception.
Yeah. Okay, great. Without question.
Okay. And did you feel your perceptions changing as you were the leader of this human counseling service?
I guess. I mean, certainly the story around the homosexuals, that is an example. Nothing comes to mind in terms of how dramatic all that was. You know, I stayed in that field for another, you know, 5 years or so. So things continued to change for me, and I think I evolved more once I left college than when I was in college.
Okay. Were you involved in any other activism during your time at UNC?
Well, just I started off in the housing department with the governorship of Morrison, and so that I did, and I actually ran for the next office up. You know, thank God I didn't get it, because everything would have changed at that point.
Right.
I was active in anti-war movements. I organized a South Campus in 1972 or whenever it was. We actually closed down the university. I don't know if you know that or not, but most of the major universities in the country closed. The students rose up and closed the universities down, and we actually didn't finish the spring semester, and I don't know if that, I think that was 72 that happened. So that was a very powerful time, and you know that's basically when they pulled out of Vietnam. That was a movement. I mean, it's a little like the fall of the Berlin Wall. Whoever thought the Berlin Wall, I mean, again, you're young, but when you start thinking that who would ever think the Soviet Union would break up, and who would ever think the Berlin Wall would come down? Who would ever think that students could rise up, influence enough of Americans that they reverse their course in Vietnam? So that was vitally important. I think all that kind of went together.
Do you have an anecdote or a specific time you remember? Maybe the first time you realized that you were making a difference in somebody, a student's life, or either an important one or the first time?
No.
No? Okay. Okay.
Should have caught me 30 years ago. Fresh in my mind.
What was the most rewarding change that occurred through, during your time at UNC, do you think?
In those 4 years, yeah. You're saying?
Mm-hmm.
I think finding my path,
yeah.
Realizing what that was the most, if I look at it today, that was the most important thing, which is I can do this, I can create things, I've basically been an innovator all my life. That's what I do. I was talking to somebody the other day down in Florida around who was similar to me in his field of whatever. And so I think that finding myself,
right.
You know, I was a lost child.
Right.
I was a child that was given responsibilities that I had no business being given. And so I was lost. And so I think I've, you know, found myself then and just felt like I could do whatever I set my mind at doing. You know, I felt grateful. I was born a Caucasian. I was born in the United States. I was born in a middle class family. I had a bright dad. And so, I mean, all that, but I think that was the biggest contribution around. But when you look at the 4 years, it's like I was part of a movement. That was very exciting to me, very rewarding to me.
Mm-hmm.
So,
you talked a little bit about the problem pregnancy conference that you planned, and just the scale of it, who was involved, and maybe the obstacles you talked about a little bit. Is there anything about that you'd like to touch on again, or do you mind describing kind of what maybe the atmosphere of the actual event was? You said people came from all over.
Sure. Well, every county had, as far as I remember, I think all 100 or maybe 97, every county had someone either from the Department of Social Services or the Health Department represented there. So, and that we brought together those 7 statewide organizations, the university was part of it, that was dramatic. I mean, it was the only one that was the only conference that was ever held. It wasn't like it was the first annual.
Right.
So I think that was in some ways a sign of the beginning of changes, not so much that we brought those changes. When I left the university, I took a job at the Carolina Population Center called the, I think it was the State Services Office, the Mental Health Project. And there we, you know, that's what we did next, which is we had a contract to go into all the 4 regions of the state, Department of Social Services, the 4 institutions for the mentally retarded, the health department, and train those staff members in how to work with sexual issues. And the first thing that we did in those trainings was called a sex attitude reassessment. And we would bring them in, see, here it comes, in small groups, but we would, in the large group, show sexually explicit films.
Mm-hmm.
We could not do that today.
Right.
Show sexually explicit films, bestiality, homosexuality, paraplegics having sex, and then break into small groups and talk about what that was like.
Wow.
It was called, you know, it was an implosion.
Mm-hmm.
And it was to desensitize them so
right.
that they could talk to people who were having trouble. These institutions of mental retarded back then took the doors off the bathroom stalls to keep them from hiding there and having sex. So there was it was punitive, shaming environment.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're not asking me about what happened after that, but I'm just saying there was that was the movement from
mm-hmm.
the workshop on problem pregnancy counseling to making that connection with those groups and then beginning to do those trainings. And we got no flack from anyone in the state. And you know, then I wrote a, we took the book that we gave out, The Problem Pregnancy Counseling,
right.
Family Life Publications, which is a publishing company, took it, we rewrote it, we released it as a national book. Prompt pregnancy, abortion, it's called Abortion Prompt Pregnancy Counseling, something like that. And I forget where all, what else I was going to say about all of that, but that, you know, that was that movement forward. Oh, and I wrote, they're called, I forget what they're called in terms of a kind of a self-guided, in self-instructional booklet, a nice 8.5 by 11 one on contraceptive education, where if you know what that is, you know, you do a kind of a small chapter and then you got a quiz there and you fill it in and then you go back and you study it again. Though, so we were able to publish that, and I published a little booklet on sexual counseling that came out of that, and that started getting distributed to the state. So it all, you know, we just kept passing it forward.
Right.
So, and you were saying what was the most important thing, and I think part of that, which was that it, you know,
part of the momentum.
Yeah, it just brought a momentum forward, and I could continue to do the work and was allowed. Again, we, you know, doing the groups, small groups, we were all my buddies, like 7 of us or so, and long-haired, bearded, you know, guys that, you know, were really good and innovative, but was there not one?
Yeah.
Were. Hello? So,
oh, yeah, sorry about it. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm with an interview.
That's fine. Yeah, if you need a minute to speak with her.
No. So, the other thing I was just saying is that it would never happen today in 2013, what we did back in 1974, 75, 76.
Right.
So.
But that's what needed to happen.
Yeah, and it was, you know, there was this momentum that was going, obviously not me, but the whole culture enough to allow that to occur. So these were training for trainers. So we would train staff on how to do the training in their location. So there was, that was, again, passing it forward. So
right. Kind of focusing on your momentum a little bit, where did you go after working at the Carolina Population Services, and how did what you did next kind of bring you to where you are today?
I was the only one of all my friends who didn't work at a restaurant or throw pizzas or something.
Yeah.
I was the only white collar guy, any of my friends. Well, so I did that for 3 years, and then I went to master's degree in counseling at Antioch University, and then from there went into my PhD in clinical psychology. So,
great.
And I switched from sexuality to, once I got in my doctoral program, to chronic pain work.
Mm-hmm.
And so my dissertation was on depression, pain, and therapeutic activity. And so I did chronic pain work for, but again, in that kind of same kind of self-help mode of
right.
counseling and helping them get a hold of things. And then from the pain work, for a number of years, people started, again, interesting stuff around the anxiety disorders, because the media in the late 70s started talking about panic disorder and agoraphobia. I was in a specialty practice at Mount Auburn Hospital in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and people just started coming through my door who had agoraphobia,
mm-hmm.
severe restriction of your lifestyle based on fear of panic.
Right.
And, you know, nobody knew what to do, but because I had worked with chronic pain patients, I knew relaxation training and hypnosis and biofeedback and so forth. And then I got this affinity with them, like I did around the sexuality, which is, I didn't have any kind of anxiety disorder, but I just had an affinity. I mean, that's
right.
what happened in my undergraduate. I had an affinity for what this was like. And when I started seeing these people, it just somehow made sense to me, and that was just wonderful.
Right.
And, you know, and then I did a crazy thing, which is I said, oh, well, I'm going to write a book on this stuff. And I said, 6 months, piece of cake, I'll do it. And then it took me 3 years. I think that's how you get married, too. You go, oh, you go into this dreamlike state, mm-hmm. and then do, you know, and so, you know, that began that whole career, so.
Right, so your transition into anxiety disorder, that came more out of a need rather than your specific interest, or do you think it was a combination of the
two? Everybody was seeing these, their patients were coming through everybody's door, mm-hmm. and nobody knew what to do, just like the sexuality stuff. And so again, I saw this little kind of niche, that's probably a poor choice of words, but this arena where there was nothing, there was no books, there were no textbooks, there was just a dearth of information about what to do and how to help people, and that made me feel like I gotta get going. Let's do this, you know.
Right.
So, and you know, so there it is. I mean, I have that affinity has remained. I mean, that's what I've been doing for 30 years now. So
right.
And I'm so happy.
Awesome.
I mean, I am. I'm so happy. I'm so happy.
That's amazing. One thing, when I talked to Dr. Schoenbach, one thing he mentioned that I found surprising was his, let me think about how to phrase this. He didn't realize, he said he was very radical and didn't realize until he was looking back that maybe he was too radical for the time, because on reflection, he realized that maybe some people didn't need to have sexual affirmation as the main thing to preach. Do you have any things like that, looking back, that you can reflect on now, seeing that maybe that wasn't the right thing to say, or anything that, looking back, your ideas have changed on?
Well, just the one thing that I mentioned already around having released my data to the media.
Right.
I think that was mm-hmm. over the... I mean, I'm second-guessing myself now, and I think there was some ego involved in that and some attention-seeking that over... I mean, I could justify doing it. I totally could sense that, but that was the... I think that was probably the biggest thing that I did. You know, given all the sexuality thing, I am an introvert, and mm-hmm. and so I, you know, I think, and actually the end of the report of, I can remember writing a report of that first year and saying, you know, you have to have a little distance from the people you're working with because you have to make decisions and so forth, and you can't just be best friends with everybody. But that was also my personality, and mm-hmm. you know, what I know now as a psychologist is that people develop theories based on their personality and their character. I do what I do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've got so many colleagues that do mindful meditation and relaxation, and I'm a restless person. I don't
mm-hmm.
sit still like that. So my protocol no longer has any of that there. So I think, again, you know, whether Vic feels like he was too radical, I don't know quite what that means. I don't have regrets. Like that, I think the most humiliating of events I had was a reporter from the Chapel Hill newspaper, and you could probably find this,
mm-hmm.
Interviewed me, and when it was probably 72, I would guess, and he called later and said, you know, I've always had a photographic memory, and somehow it didn't work, and so I want to interview you again. I'm bringing my tape recorder. And so he brought a tape recorder and interviewed me, and then he used the literal transcripts of the interview to show me stumbling and having incomplete sentences and using whatever slang or whatever.
Right.
And purposely to, I mean, it was all a setup, you know, purposely to make me look bad. And that was,
wow.
That was a humiliation to me. And there's nothing I could have done about that. I was just
right.
set up, and, you know, there it was.
How malicious.
Know. Yeah. And I don't, you know, you'd think newspaper reporters wouldn't be into that, but you know, I wasn't articulate when I was being interviewed with him, but I never get interviewed.
Right.
I'm not good at that. And of course the spoken word's different than the if you ever transcribe any of these things, you'll know the spoken word doesn't work well on the written page. So that's all I have for you on that question.
Yeah. Just kind of bringing it back to Carolina, and also I don't know what time it is, so I don't want to take up too much of yours.
6:47, so okay. You got eight more minutes.
What were the highlights of your time at Carolina, I guess, aside from, were they all of the work that you did, or were a lot of your memories of Carolina outside of that, or was it mostly focused, or?
Well, you may know the answer to this yourself. All my learnings were outside of classroom. I didn't learn things in classrooms. The lessons of Carolina are your life as a student. You finding that to be true?
Yeah.
Okay. So that for me, that was it. To do the honors thesis was really interesting and useful to me. I mean, it was the first time I did research. It was complex. And I could handle that. It was back when we were, research back then, you're using little, you don't know anything about how it was back then. You know, we had one computer in the entire school, and it was as big as this whole wing of the building in sociology department. And you have every little piece of data is on a card, and you carry around boxes of these cards stacked in an exact order, and you can't change that order. And the way you fix it is, so it was a really complex. So I have this kind of, in a positive way, an obsessive compulsive kind of thinking because I can organize all that. And that, to take on a project that large and to master it, and then to find out, I had my first publication at 20 years old. So that was fascinating to me, all of that. So in many ways, I kept my head down. I would stay in Morrison Dorm over Thanksgiving and work. I really worked a lot. Mm-hmm. I played hard, absolutely, but I was driven.
Right.
Always been driven.
Was there anything that I didn't mention that you'd like to talk about, or?
No, it would be great if you could track down Dr. Crist. He's in Fayette, or he was.
He's in Jacksonville.
And it'd be interesting. And you don't know much about him. He's also been a collector of art from Cyprus. And so he actually opened a museum down there with all of that, those works. So he's done some interesting things on the side, too. He had a very powerful career as, working from pregnancy and abortion. And he carried a .38 under his seat of his car. He was threatened so many times. You got military people and so forth. So he stuck his neck out and done some great things. And it'd be wonderful to, if you could have some time. And you didn't find Bill Griffin.
I haven't heard that name actually yet.
It may have an S on the end of it. He was a master's in school public health.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I were buddies at the beginning of doing all of this stuff. And so I don't know where his work got carved out from mine, but he was somebody who was important. And Lana Starnes, did you look around for her at all? Because she's the student who wrote Elephants and Butterflies column.
Mm-hmm.
With Dr. Crist, and she would be an interesting person to talk to if she were around somewhere. My old girlfriend was Emily Keenan.
Mm-hmm.
That's the Keenan family, Keenan Stadium, Keenan Oil.
Mm-hmm.
You haven't checked her out at all?
I don't think she lives in the area.
I think she's in Charleston, right. South Carolina. I'll say no more on the record.
No more on the record. Great. I've had trouble getting in touch with Dr. Crist, I think, because of the nature of his work. But
he's long retired, so.
Right. Thank you so much for agreeing to speak with me and for giving the SOHP your story.
Good. Cool. Thanks. I have some questions after you turn it off.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. And one more.